a migrant caravan chanting as thousands of men, women, and children make their way north to seek asylum in Mexico or in the United States. We are migrants, not criminals, they say. Why do they kill us? The group began just a week and a half ago with only 160 people in Honduras. But as it traveled through Honduras, Guatemala, and then toward Mexico, it grew and grew into the thousands. We begin today with the latest on the caravan of thousands of Central American migrants escaping the Northern Triangle through Mexico. After federal police in Mexico attempted to block the migrants' entry into the country last week, President Trump tweeted his praise for the move and spoke about it during the signing of a presidential memorandum in Arizona.
So as of this moment, I thank Mexico. I hope they continue, but as of this moment, I thank Mexico. If that doesn't work out, we're calling up the military, not the guard. We're calling up the military. And we're going to have the military stationed. They're not coming into this country. They might as well turn back.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. Here to talk about Mexico's migration enforcement policies, as well as the U.S.'s role in those plans, is Maya Averbach. She's a freelance reporter currently writing for The New York Times, who is with the migrants in Chiapas, Mexico.
There are people who are generally coming from Honduras, so there are others from El Salvador and Guatemala. They're all from Central America and are heading north, often because of dire economic conditions where they've been living, at times because the cities or towns where they live in have become quite violent. There's a high rate of gang violence in Central America. And these different factors have pressed people to leave their countries. And you see a rise also in the number of families who are traveling together. You see a lot of parents with little kids, which we've seen over the past few years, but it's particularly noticeable when the group is this large.
I'm just curious, what has been the Mexican response to migrants? Have they used force to prevent them from moving forward?
When the migrants first came to the bridge between Mexico and Guatemala, that's the official entry point, the Mexican government and the Guatemalan government had police blocking the entry point. The Mexican government had riot police there. That riot police, as you might have seen in news reports, used tear gas to try to repel the crowd and succeeded in at least pushing them back enough so that the gate that they had pushed open could be closed again. And then the government said that it would start processing people. It's so far processed a little bit more than 300 people a day. And that has been the main use of force. Since then, the Mexican government has pretty much not tried to stop the migrants. There are too many migrants for them to really do anything other than escort people as they go by. So we've seen a police presence. There was a police helicopter flying around. There's a large federal police force that has come down specifically because of this mass migration. But at this point, it's also left to municipal governments to try to figure out, where do we put all these people? Can we fit them into a stadium? Can we fit them into parks? Can we fit them into some sort of municipal auditorium? And that ends up being the larger question that has to be answered, because the Mexican government is not about to stop these thousands of people from walking through. What they have done is tried to encourage people to apply for some sort of legal status, be that refugee status in Mexico, it's the equivalent of asylum, or some other sort of paperwork. They've mentioned visas. In the past, there's been the option to get sort of a safe passage permit, as happened in the last caravan. But people are generally distrustful of the government in various spaces. The government has said you can stay here to rest. There are fairgrounds in Tapachula and another space where we are now in Wixla, and people have generally exited those government-sanctioned spaces out of fear that they might be deported.
At what point is the Mexican government or any of these governments thinking that this could become a humanitarian crisis if there are nowhere, is there really nowhere for these folks to go?
I mean, I think this is already a humanitarian crisis and people are going to keep going north. The question is what will happen along the route, whether the government will try to intervene later on, what the U.S. government will try to do to intervene. And I also think that there are just hardships of walking these distances in the incredible sun with few resources that are going to be apparent. Mexico has its own long history of migration. And so there are also people who you will find who will say that some of the Central Americans are criminals who think they've been paid, or different rumors that you also hear in the U.S. On the other hand, there are many people who have turned out, whether they're just from local community groups or from church groups or people who just walk out of their houses, and have had a far friendlier response and have tried to help out.
Maya Averbach is a freelance journalist in Mexico. Maya, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
On Monday morning, the president had this response to the mass migration on Twitter. Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador were not able to do the job of stopping people from leaving their country and coming illegally to the U.S. We will now begin cutting off or substantially reducing the massive foreign aid routinely given to them, said the president. Well, that could mean even more cuts in aid to the region. In 2016, the United States Congress allocated $750 million for development assistance in Central America. In the 2018 budget, that request, that number was reduced to $460 million. So what can we make of the president's latest threat? Joining me now to answer that question is Mark Feirstein. Feirstein was former assistant administrator for Latin America and the Caribbean at the U.S. Agency for International Development. And today he's a senior advisor at the Albright Stonebridge Group. Mark, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you. A pleasure to be here.
So what exactly, I mean, can the president make good on that threat to either unilaterally cut off or substantially reduce foreign aid?
In short, no. The president cannot do that. Congress has the power of the purse. Congress appropriates money, and the executive branch is required to spend it. Now, Congress can make a decision to cut assistance, limit assistance, but I think it's important to point out that the assistance that we've been providing to Central America for decades, and particularly the increases in the last few years, and you mentioned the increase in 2016, that increase had bipartisan support. Both Democrats and Republicans recognize that the way to reduce migration is to improve the lives of the people in Central America and Guatemala and El Salvador, and to strengthen the capacity of these governments to reduce crime and to reduce poverty.
Well,
and if we,
And
if we, obviously it'd be counterproductive if we were to cut this assistance, because that would just lead to more migration.
So then the question is, we have cut that assistance. In 2016, it was $750 million. And in 2018, the budget request is now down to $460 million. What gives there? What's that about?
Well, this is an administration that doesn't really believe in foreign assistance, and a president who doesn't appreciate and understand the value of foreign assistance. He tends to see it as a gift. And what he doesn't understand is that whether we're spending it in El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, or other places around the world, it's really in the U.S. national interest to be supporting these countries. And I think there are four reasons in particular with regard to Central America. Obviously, we're trying to reduce migration. We do that by helping these countries to, as I noted, to reduce crime, reduce poverty. There are commercial reasons to support foreign assistance as these countries, as people in these countries become wealthier, as they move into middle class, they become consumers. And they become, therefore, consumers of U.S. products, and that creates jobs in the United States. There's also national security reasons. There are drug trafficking organizations, gangs that operate in these countries, and we have an interest in strengthening the capacity of these countries to combat those organizations. And again, there are humanitarian reasons. I mean, people are living in poverty and desperate conditions in these places, and we have an obligation as a prosperous country to try to provide assistance to them.
And 4 years after the migration crisis that caused President Obama to respond, we seem to be in a similar situation. And I'm wondering, is there any way to evaluate how much of the aid went and where it was supposed to go? Has the aid been effective?
That's an important question. And I think AID and other organizations do their best to try to assess the impact of the aid. And I'll offer one example. USAID a few years ago basically began a pilot program, and they looked at the areas of the country where there was the highest levels of crime, and then they invested a great amount in certain areas, and then in certain areas they did not, and they saw that the areas where they were investing, where they were training police, where they were providing assistance to youth and building youth centers and giving them providing them with job opportunities and job training. They found that in those areas where the investments were being made, crime went down, and the areas where the investments were not being made, crime went up. Now, the key is obviously to scale up those programs over time and to empower these countries to carry out the programs on their own. But I think there is, you know, good evidence that in many cases that the aid programs have been working. But we have to continue to evaluate, and where programs are not working, they need to be revised or eliminated.
Well, and there's also critics of the policy, of U.S. policy in Central America, who would say that the U.S. is partly responsible for a lot of the political climate that we see in these countries, like Honduras. How do you respond to that?
Well, look, the United States has a checkered history in Latin America, but I think in recent years, the United States has been largely very supportive of democratic movements there, been supportive of human rights, and I think there has been some setbacks in this administration. But I think certainly during the Bush administration, during the Clinton and Obama administrations, we saw strong support for democratic movements in the hemisphere and strong support for them to improve their governance. And unfortunately, I think we're seeing a diminishing of that now. This president and this administration does not put emphasis on democracy and human rights in the way previous administrations did. Look, foreign policy is always a balance of values and interests, and this administration puts the scale very heavily on interests and limits the importance of values.
Well, but it also seems to be having a direct impact. I mean, the president is now threatening to cut aid as this caravan makes its way north.
Well, look, I'd be surprised, to be honest, if the assistance is in fact cut. I think he's going to get some pushback within his own administration. People in the State Department, USAID, Department of Justice, DEA, I think they all recognize the importance of supporting their partners in these countries. So I'd be very surprised if we do in fact see a cut in assistance. I think this is just empty bluster on the part of the president, and it's one of many examples.
Mark Feirstein served as Assistant Administrator for Latin America and the Caribbean at USAID, and he's currently the Senior Advisor at the Albright Stonebridge Group. Thanks for joining us, Mark.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
All information and evidence shows that Cemal Khashoggi was killed in a violent, savage murder.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan spoke in detail about the murder of dissident Saudi writer Cemal Khashoggi for the first time today. While the murder has sparked international outrage, it's also shown a spotlight on Turkey's contentious relationship with Saudi Arabia and its own history with suppressing press freedoms. According to Amnesty International, Turkey has one of the highest rates of jailed journalists in the world. Borzu Daragahi is an international correspondent for The Independent based in Istanbul, Turkey. Hi, Borzu.
It's a pleasure.
So Erdogan was silent on Khashoggi's death for weeks. Why did he choose to speak now?
Well, he wasn't exactly silent. He spoke about this tragedy. Where is this journalist? He did bring him up. He mentioned him, but he didn't lay out the case and confirm some of the evidence as he did today. Knowing a little bit about him, he's a pretty emotional guy, so I don't think it's just, you know, pure politics. But that is also an issue. You know, Turkey and Saudi Arabia have been at odds for 5 years since the coup in Egypt in 2013. And that tension has gotten even worse in the last 3 years with the rise of the young crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman, who has, you know, close ties to some people Erdogan considers enemies, including neoconservatives in Washington and so on. And he sees MBS as the sort of weak link that he can hammer away at. And so I think any consideration of what Erdogan is doing, what his timing is, and so on, has to take that factor into account.
Now, we also know that the Turkish government is, as much as they're outspoken about Khashoggi's murder, they have their own record on press suppression. And do you think that that's part of the calculation here in Erdogan's response?
I think that's a really good question. I'm not sure if he sees himself as an enemy of the free press. You know, he sees the journalists that he puts into jail and the newspapers that he shuts down, not as paragons of free press, but as, you know, sort of hostile political organizations that are out to get him, hostile players who are lying and smearing him and so on. He doesn't see them necessarily as a free press. He doesn't see himself as a free press enemy. But I'm sure that his handlers, who have gotten a little bit better as of late, are making that calculation.
What about Turkey in terms of the rest of the region? Is it, where does it stand economically? What about the issues that it has itself with terrorism?
Yeah, I mean, those are kind of separate questions. But, you know, Turkey economically is in trouble. It's the lira, the Turkish lira is down 40% this year. However, one of the things that's kept the economy from completely tanking is real estate. And that's largely because of money pouring in from the Gulf and other countries. It also doesn't want to really, really upset the Trump administration. The director of the CIA was dispatched here yesterday. We're not privy to what the conversations were, but I'm sure some of the tone of what was talked about was to the effect of, please don't torpedo Mohammed bin Salman. We need him for our grand plan to confront Iran.
So then why are they doing this? Why are they speaking out against what happened here? It just seems like they're trying to have it two ways.
Absolutely. And that explains a lot of what the Turks are doing. They want it two ways. They want to get rid of MBS, or weaken him at least, and achieve some of their regional strategic goals in terms of torpedoing this plan to confront Iran and possibly kind of plunge the region into another war that Turkey is quite afraid of, while at the same time keeping that flow of capital coming from the Gulf and keeping the U.S. from punishing it over certain things, including the case of the bank, Halk Bank, that has been indicted in the U.S. and faces a possible very, very large fine for laundering Iranian money.
You mentioned that CIA Director Gina Haspel is there in Turkey, and I'm wondering, I know those conversations aren't public, but is there any sense that this could potentially help Turkey's relationship with the United States, or what's this visit about more generally?
Well, I think that, you know, Turkey senses that to some extent that it has, you know, the U.S. right where it wants it on this case. They have the means, they think, to really, really weaken this Saudi alliance, the Saudi, U.S., Israel, UAE, Egypt sort of alliance that Turkey perceives as being arrayed against it. And the Trump administration, kind of perhaps panicking a little bit over what Erdogan might do, may have dispatched the CIA director here to sort of try to talk reason to Erdogan, saying, look, you know, we don't have to do it this way. Please don't do it like this. Here's what we can offer, and possibly some implicit threats as well.
And what about the Turks themselves? What's the reaction been, if you can tell? Are they supporters? Are they supportive of Erdogan? Where do people stand right now?
Well, I mean, everyone is just totally intrigued by this story. It's an amazing, you know, sort of crime story. It's like an episode of The Americans or, you know, some kind of TV serial, kind of outlandish, unbelievable sort of details that are people here are just gobbling it up. But I think on a broader political level, you know, you have various constituencies in the Turkish political body. Some of them support Erdogan and some of them don't. But for various reasons, all of them are united in this case in wanting to know what happened to Jamal Khashoggi. I think not least of all because he's a Saudi citizen and an Arab, but he's also of Turkish descent. You know, in the Turkish newspapers, they write his name with the Turkish spelling, Jamal Khashoggi, and so on. That's a very popular name in Turkey. It means spoon maker. And so there's a lot of sympathy for this guy. He was here in Istanbul marrying a Turkish woman. Turks love that story and so on. He was here to he bought an apartment here. He was going to make it his home. And this story has fascinated them. But you have the Islamists who sympathize somewhat with Jamal Khashoggi's political points of view. You have the nationalists who view this as a violation of Turkish sovereignty. And you have the liberals, Democrats, secularists, so to speak, who see in Jamal Khashoggi just another journalist who was murdered by an authoritarian state. And so you have these three big constituencies in Turkey, and all are supporting this investigation.
Borzu Daragahi is an international correspondent for The Independent based in Istanbul, Turkey. Borzu, thank you for your reporting and stay safe out there.
It's been a pleasure.
Today's podcast is sponsored by Babbel. People around the world are learning new languages with the Babbel Language Learning app. Learn Spanish, French, Italian, German, Russian, Swedish, and more with Babbel's 10 to 15 minute lessons. You'll learn through interactive dialogues, speech recognition, and fun trainers and quizzes. And in a few short weeks, you can be speaking a new language with confidence. And Babbel is available as an app or online. And right now, you can try Babbel for free. Go to Babbel.com and download the app and try it for free. That's right, Babbel, B-A-B-B-L-E.com, or download the app to try it for free. Babbel.com.
Coming up, we're talking about the Pregnancy Discrimination Act of 1978, the only federal law on the books that protects pregnant women at work. Over the weekend, the New York Times reported on women working in physically demanding jobs who were being denied requests for light duty during pregnancy, which led to an alarming number of miscarriages. So we wanted to hear from you about your experiences being pregnant at work. Were there accommodations made for you, or were you denied any requests?
Hi, I'm Lindsay from New Jersey. I was verbally promised a long-awaited promotion and raise right before I became pregnant. I had my baby, I took an unpaid 3-month leave and came back full-time, only to find out the position in the raise I had been promised was no longer on the table. When I told my boss that I was seeking another employment opportunity, he suggested that I find something new with fewer hours, closer to home, so that I could spend more time with the baby and enjoying motherhood. I did leave and I continue to work full-time at a better organization with a better salary.
Hi, this is Kathy from Fort Lauderdale, Florida. I was pregnant at work 3 times in the 80s. I never received nor did I ask for any accommodations. I worked for a Fortune 50 company and never wanted anyone to have a reason to stall or end my career progression.
Hi, this is Emily from Philadelphia. Being the first person to have a baby in the previous 8 years at my company was pretty hard. Accommodations were made and I got my time off, but HR often made me feel like I should be happy with the minimum and that I was asking for something extra when simply trying to access my FMLA and my paid time off. Breastfeeding was also a challenge. There isn't a room for this at work, so I had to use my office.
In 1978, the Pregnancy Discrimination Act was passed to protect against discrimination based on pregnancy, childbirth, or other related medical conditions. But 40 years later, how well is the Pregnancy Discrimination Act protecting the modern workforce? Deborah Dinner is an associate law professor at Emory University, and she joins me now. Deborah, thanks for being with us.
Hello, thanks for having me.
So tell us, how is this law meant to protect pregnant women?
Well, what the Pregnancy Discrimination Act of 1978 does, and I'll call it the PDA, is it amends Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And Title VII is the law that prohibits discrimination on the basis of sex, as well as race, color, religion, and national origin. And what the PDA does is it defines sex discrimination to include pregnancy and discrimination on the basis of related medical conditions, including childbirth.
So what are some of the limitations to this law? I understand it's a conditional law. Can you tell us what that means?
So what the Pregnancy Discrimination Act does is it says that you can't refuse to hire someone just because she's pregnant, or you can't deny a promotion to pregnant women because you have stereotypes about motherhood. And it requires that pregnant persons and persons affected by childbirth be treated just the same as other persons who are similar in, quote, their ability or inability to work. It's a requirement, effectively, of same treatment. So the biggest limitation of the PDA is that it's only an anti-discrimination mandate, and it leaves many workers bereft of protection. And so what it doesn't require doesn't guarantee an affirmative entitlement to an accommodation in the workplace. So let's imagine a managerial professional in a Fortune 500 company who's fortunate enough and lucky enough to work in a workplace that gives generous paid leave. So if she broke her leg, she could get, say, 4 weeks of paid leave. Similarly, if she became pregnant and needed leave before childbirth or after childbirth, she could get 4 weeks of paid childbirth because she would be treated the same. But let's imagine people who work in warehouses, like in the recent New York Times article. They work in low-income jobs where they are much less likely to have generalized protections for disability. So there, the employer gives no, for example, no light duty accommodations to any worker when they fall ill. In that workplace, an anti-discrimination mandate does not get you very far. So just the requirement under the PDA that pregnant workers be treated the same as other temporarily disabled workers doesn't get them much protection. So they won't be given light duty, which poses a risk to their health and the health of their fetuses.
Now, I wonder, does this have anything to do with the fact that pregnancy is considered a disability clause in this law? Because it feels like we're treating pregnancy the same as we would a quote-unquote disability and not as a separate category. Is that right?
Yeah. The law, it's important to recognize, does not actually mention the word disability. What the law says is that sex discrimination under Title VII includes pregnancy. And then it gives an example. And it says that, for example, pregnant women should get the same benefits as other employees who are similar or in their ability or inability to work. So it might be helpful to explain a little bit where this idea of temporary disability came from. Feminist lawyers in the 70s were really worried that any law that specially protected pregnant women would lead to hiring discrimination. And so they promoted kind of an approach that was sex neutral, that analogized between pregnancy and temporary disability in order to use anti-discrimination as a kind of bootstrap to get pregnant women some of the benefits that were available for temporarily disabled workers generally, and to prohibit employment discrimination on the basis of pregnancy. But again, this leaves the workers who most need protection bereft of protection because it doesn't provide a positive entitlement to the kinds of accommodations that are necessary for the health and safety of pregnant workers.
Now, how much has this law changed in the past 40 years, and what do you see as the future of it?
Yeah, I think the law has evolved. So, for example, in the 2015 decision, Young v. UPS, the Supreme Court expanded what would count as disparate treatment on the basis of pregnancy, or what would count as kind of the differential treatment of pregnancy that was unlawful. So if an employer, for example, gives accommodations to a large percentage of its workforce for whatever reason, but not to pregnant workers, that now can be considered unlawful. Another advance in the law we've seen is that stereotyping pregnant women is itself in a way that leads to kind of an adverse employment action, a firing or a failure to promote or a denial of benefits, that those kinds of gender stereotypes are themselves unlawful.
What gender stereotypes are you referring to?
Well, for example, I think that one of the calls, the woman from New Jersey who was told by her supervisor that she needed to take more time off work or have a kind of less demanding job because she should spend more time with the baby. Those are the kinds of gender stereotypes that are actually still very prevalent. The notion that a new mother won't be able to be as committed to the workforce because she's now committed to her child more than she is to her job. Those are the kinds of gender stereotypes that could be probative of unlawful sex discrimination under the PDA.
Deborah Dinner is associate law professor at Emory University, and she has a book coming out called The Sex Equality Dilemma, Work, Family, and Legal Change in Neoliberal America. Deborah, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
This week on the show, we've been talking about the gears, the levers, the people, and the coordination that make up our election process here in the United States. On Monday's show, we heard about why the system is so fractured, which has Americans voting differently all across the country. And when it comes to securing elections, that's one of the many reasons there are flaws in the design.
If we're talking about the physical infrastructure, there's no question. A lot has been done in the past couple of years since the 2016 election, but there's a lot more that we should be doing to invest in that system and to make sure that it is working properly for everyone.
We are operating a system across this country that is completely out of step with the rest of the world, with other nations to which we compare ourselves. And we could be doing so much better in terms of having a much more inclusive electorate that reflects the demographics of the country.
That's Janae Nelson, Associate Director Counsel of the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund, and Larry Norden, Deputy Director of the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice. I asked them to take us through the vulnerabilities in our system and tell us who pays the price for those holes.
The Brennan Center, just this past March, did a survey of election officials. Officials in 33 states said they needed to replace their equipment before 2020. The vast majority of them did not have the funds to do so. And this isn't an abstract problem. In most cases, these machines are no longer manufactured. Too often, that means election officials, believe it or not, are turning to eBay to find replacement parts. And perhaps most disturbingly for those of us who work in the space, you still have 13 states that are using systems without any kind of paper backup. And that means if there's any kind of question about the results, there's no independent record to check the software with. Since 2016, we haven't made as much progress as I would like in replacing those systems.
Janae, I want to ask you, when you hear the challenges, the physical infrastructure challenges that Larry is pointing out, do you make a connection there between the physical infrastructure and voter suppression? Are those two things connected? And if so, how?
Yes, I think they're quite related because they all are part of what I call a crisis of integrity in our election system. There are concerns not only about how votes are cast and counted, but also how people are able to have access to the polls and whether the equipment is equitably distributed, whether the opportunities to vote are equitably distributed. And what we're seeing across the country are numerous devices to keep the American public from the polls, and particularly minority communities. They are becoming the largest portion of the electorate. And it's extraordinarily concerning that there are so many different ways in which we make voting difficult for eligible voters in this country. What we know is that this electorate is slowly being curated and handcrafted by election officials who can manipulate who gets on the voter registration rolls, and once they get there, who has an opportunity to cast a ballot in a fair and free and equal way.
And why doesn't the federal government take that role? I mean, I feel like if we're talking about something that has this many holes, that has disenfranchised people, and is so critical to what this country is, i.e. a democracy or a republic, then why isn't this taken care of?
Well, I would say that it should be that there should be some minimum standards when it comes to both election system security and investing in our infrastructure and in making sure that citizens have the right to vote. But in fact, if anything, we've seen the opposite in recent years. You have the Supreme Court striking down critical sections of the Voting Rights Act, which has made it much easier for local jurisdictions to frankly manipulate the process and for partisans to decide who can vote and who can't vote. And you've got the same thing when it comes to the election infrastructure. Congress basically saying, you know, it's the state's responsibility, and the state's often saying it's the county responsibility. And what happens is you have vastly different standards, not only between states, but even within states.
Larry, I want to ask you about cybersecurity. We hear about this a lot. There's been all this talk about how vulnerable our systems can be to hacking, for example, to international interference or foreign interference. What are the vulnerabilities today, and are they different than they were in 2016?
I'm not sure that they're any different than they were in 2016. The election infrastructure is vast, so there's a lot of focus often on voting machines themselves. But if you look at what was targeted in 2016, and frankly has been targeted in elections abroad in the past few years, it's things like the voter registration database, election websites, electronic poll books, which we use in 34 states, all these things that people use to figure out where they should be voting, and then election officials use to make sure that people are entitled to vote. And interference with any of these systems can create confusion, make it more difficult for people to vote, and often what the intention is, create doubt in the integrity of a system. I do want to say, you know, because there's all this doom and gloom talk about these things, we do have procedures in place that should mean that even if there is some kind of cyber attack or interference or frankly mistake, right? No election is run perfectly ever, that people should still be able to vote and have their votes counted. So I'll just give you one for instance, because we've seen this in past elections. If there are problems with electronic poll books or people are showing up and their names aren't on the registration rolls, but they believe they're registered, they're entitled to a provisional ballot under federal law. Under the Help America Vote Act, if you're told that you're not registered to vote and you believe you are, you can fill out a form and they can vote a ballot and they can figure out later if there was some kind of problem. And nobody, if they see a problem with their registration, and people should check their registration online, you can do that virtually everywhere in the United States. If they see a problem, they should tell their election officials, but there is an election protection hotline. The phone number is 866-OUR-VOTE, and there are experts there that can help and that can make sure that you get to cast that ballot.
Janae, what about you? What is something that you would like voters to know about this system going into the midterms?
You know, we pay a lot of attention to foreign interference in our elections, as we should, but we cannot ignore the fact that many voters, and especially voters of color, are at greater risk of being disenfranchised by state and local officials. And that's something that should be absolutely unacceptable in our democracy today. So we at the NAACP Legal Defense Fund are encouraging everyone to be prepared to vote. That is, check your registration in advance, do everything you can to be prepared when you go to the polls, and be prepared to stick it out, to wait it out if necessary, and to cast your ballot.
Larry Norden is the Deputy Director of the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice, and Janae Nelson is the Associate Director Counsel of the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund. Thanks to you both for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Rod from East Rutherford. I'm glad the takeaway is having this discussion. I have a friend in Ohio who is learning disabled because of a childhood head injury. He's had a lot of trouble with voting machines, and he called me and told me that he was concerned because, according to the instructions on the ballot, any mistakes are punishable as a fifth-degree felony in Ohio. And he's concerned that if he makes a mistake and submits the ballot, that he may do some jail time.
Thanks for your comment, Rod. We're going to be talking about this more tomorrow. Thanks so much for being with us today. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.